spit comes out of Brian's mouth as he yells. I want to slap him. I want him to hurt. A smile spreads across his lips as he turns away. For the first time, I'm aware of the tension in my body, a rubber band stretched to its limit. I let my shoulders relax from my ears. I blink back tears. I won't let myself cry. Not over this. Violet moves in to hug me. I'm so sorry, she breathes. Please, you don't need to be sorry.
You're right. Enough of the Hallmark moment, she says, taking my elbow. She knows I want to move on. Let's get to class. I doubt Brian will bother you again.
The first half of the school day passes routinely. I don't see Brian anywhere, but clearly word's gotten around. That's one of the things I hate most about a small high school. Everyone knows everything immediately. There's not even a semblance of anonymity or privacy. At lunch, I want to grab a salad and keep my head down, but Phil walks up to me at the salad bar. It's the first time we've been in any sort of proximity since the painfully awkward crying moment in his car.
I heard about what Brian said to you,
he says, staring down at his tray.
I'm sorry. He's an ass. I'm going to talk to him. I should have said something to him before.
His voice trails off, like his mind has wandered away. I give Phil a quizzical look. Don't worry about it. It's no one else's fault. Besides, I'm over it. You kinda have to have a thick skin if you happen to be Muslim and live in America. I want to talk to Phil. I want to snare his attention, but not for this. And I definitely don't want to open myself up to being hurt. Again.
So, whatever happened with NYU?
He asks. I'm going. My parents gave in. He finally looks up, his face bright.
That's amazing. Congratulations. I'm really happy for you.
I look into Phil's smiling eyes. For a second, my defenses come down. My heart leaps from my chest. I smile and thanks.
Listen, Maya, I've been meaning to talk to you.
Phil takes a hesitant half-step closer to me.
I'm sorry. Things got complicated.
You mean with Lisa? And the defenses are up again, fully reinforced. His mouth opens, but his words take their time coming out.
Well, no. I mean, I guess, but why? Maya!
I jump. Dean Anderson has said my name. His voice is impossible to miss. The one no student ever wants to hear in the cafeteria. Or anywhere else, really. Grizzly, smoked too much over the years, always a few decibels louder than necessary. Only this time, a police officer who looks barely older than me stands a couple feet behind him. The entire cafeteria tunes into the show. My chest tightens. Yes? I ask and rub my forehead.
I need to speak with you. Do you mind if we step outside?
My gaze turns to Phil for a second, searching, but I'm not sure for what. Dean Anderson adds,
Why don't you head to your table, Phil?
Phil touches my arm. It's a small gesture, protective, but I shouldn't read into it. I know better now. The hallway is empty and silent, except for my melon-colored Chuck Taylors squeaking against the linoleum.
Maya,
This is Officer Jameson,
Dean Anderson says. Officer Jameson holds out his hand.
Nice to meet you, Maya.
He takes off his glasses and tucks them in his shirt so I can see my distorted reflection in the mirrored lenses. I bite my lip. I rub my clammy hands against my jeans. You too, officer. What's going on?
Maya, there's been an incident at your parents' clinic.
The dean begins.
They're okay. Neither was seriously hurt.
What happened? My lip quivers and my voice shakes. Officer Jameson continues.
Someone threw a brick through the window.
I cut my hand to my mouth to hold in a scream.
Your dad got a gash on the forehead.
He continues in the same monotone.
A couple people in the waiting area have minor cuts from broken glass. Your mom was in a back exam room, so she's unharmed.
My dad! Did they catch who did it? I mean, why would... I look to Dean Anderson, who in turn looks back to Officer Jameson for a response. Dean Anderson can't even look me in the eye.
It appears to be a hate crime,
the officer says.
There was a note wrapped around the brick. Apparently, the bombing in Springfield angered the perpetrator. The brick through the window was a kind of warning.
A warning? It's because our last name is the same as the terrorists, isn't it?
We can't speculate right now,
Officer Jameson explains. Confusion, anger, and terror churn in my stomach. Thoughts fly through my brain at warp speed. First Brian and the altercation this morning, and now this at my parents' office. What if they attack us at home? A message? What if this is only the first? Are we? I mean, are my parents going to be safe?
Maya, I assure you the Batavia Police Department is taking this very seriously. We will find the perpetrator.
Officer Jameson says. I can see that he is trying to sound reassuring, but he might as well be telling me fairy godmothers are real, because nothing he says right now will make this okay. Can I go see my parents?
Of course,
Dean Anderson says.
Officer Jameson will take you.
Violet bursts out of the lunchroom doors and into the hall, silencing him. It probably took all her patience to wait this long. What's going on? She demands. Dean Anderson frowns.
Young lady, I believe Officer Jameson and I were having a private discussion with Maya.
Violet stares at him like he's speaking an alien language, then turns to me. Someone threw a brick through my parents' office window. I repeat the officer's words, not really believing them. My dad got cut, and a couple patients, too. It's possibly revenge for the bombing. What? No way. That's horrible. Violet turns to Officer Jameson. I assume this qualifies as a hate crime, and that the police will be pursuing every lead with all their formidable resources? Officer Jameson's mouth betrays a slight smile.
Yes, miss. I was assuring your friend that once we catch the perpetrator, we will be throwing the book at him.
Good. Maya, did you tell them about this morning? I shake my head, swallowing. This would be a good time, don't you think? Violet says. I don't want to have this discussion. Dean Anderson raises an eyebrow at us.
What happened this morning?
They need to know. Violet presses me. I hesitate, nervous what this conversation will lead to. I honestly can't deal with any more drama at school. Brian Jennings, bullied her because she's Muslim, and there are witnesses.
Why didn't you report this to me immediately?
Dean Anderson demands. I don't know how to answer. I just want this interrogation to be over.
Maya?
Officer Jameson asks.
Have there been any other incidents of this kind? Anything else off school property?
No, nothing.
I want to make it clear that you need to report any other events of this type to the school immediately. If you are threatened and you're not at school, call 911.
Officer Jameson reaches into his right front breast pocket and pulls out business cards.
You can also call me anytime, day or night. My cell phone number is on the card.
Violet eagerly takes his card. Thank you, Officer Jameson. We will all rest easier knowing you're looking out for us. Her tone changes from terse and direct to something softer. And I look up to see that she's standing right in front of him, smiling. I almost laugh. Neither time nor circumstance will stop Violet's flirting. I resist the urge to cry or hug her or both. Officer Jameson clears his throat and adjusts his collar.
Are you ready, Miss Aziz?
Violet steps closer to me. Dean Anderson, I'd like to go with Maya. She doesn't ask. It's not a matter of permission. She's going whether he approves or not. After a moment, he nods.
Okay. You're responsible for any assignments you'll miss. And I'll call Brian in about this morning's incident. Gather your things. We'll wait here.
Violet takes my arm and whisks me down the hall. I love that we're getting a police escort, she says in my ear. Yeah, I whisper, and dissolve into tears. Three men in dark suits knock on the door of a modest house in Dearborn, Michigan. Tarnished gold letters spell out Aziz on the black mailbox. It is dinner time. A woman in black pants and a loose-fitting white shirt answers the door and then calls for her husband. One of the men talks for a long time at incredibly slow speed. Though both the husband and wife speak English fluently, they look at the man as if he speaks in tongues. They turn to each other briefly, silently. Then the woman shrieks and runs wailing up the stairs into her bedroom. The husband steadies himself against the door jamb before inviting the men to enter his home. Chapter 14. Dozens of flashing lights blaze outside my parents' clinic. As Violet drives up, the world decelerates and tiny details come into sharp focus. The surreal slowness of an empty swing moving back and forth. Blades of grass seem to ripple individually, and brilliant sunlight sparkles off the jagged edges of what was once a plate glass window that named my parents' practice. Dr. and Dr. Aziz, DDS. I see my parents shaking hands with the mayor in the vestibule. Mayor Graham, Batavia's one local celebrity. If by celebrity you mean the guy who tosses candy from the back of a red convertible that leads Batavia's annual Flag Day parade. Truthfully, that parade is really popular. He knows what the job of small-town mayor is. He shows up at every football game and makes sure the garbage gets picked up and the streets get plowed when it snows. He's a good guy. My parents voted for him. Everyone did. He ran unopposed. The action lurches back to full speed. My brain is speed-ramping life from slow motion back to real time. This is not normal. None of this is normal.
I run from the car. I yank open the door, shove past the mayor, and hug my mom and dad at the same time. My whole body shakes. I step back. My dad brushes his index finger across my cheek. A tidy row of steri strips marks a spot above his left eye. Brownish-red drops of blood stand out against the white of his lab coat. Dad, are you okay? I can't believe...
Maya, can't you see that Mayor Graham was so nice to stop by?
He says, ever aware of decorum. I'm relieved, honestly. Relieved that he's himself and talking to me in the patient but admonishing tone people use to tell a 5-year-old they've done something wrong. My mom, though, is pale and disheveled. She takes pride in her perfectly neat buns, but now strands of hair are carelessly tucked behind her ears, out of place. If I act according to Dad's wishes, maybe Mom will feel better, too. Hi, Mayor Graham. I say, thank you for checking in on my parents.
No need to thank me, Maya,
he says. He pauses, waiting until I return his gaze. Maybe he wants to know that I'm reassured by his presence, that I know he takes this seriously. What he doesn't understand is that right now, nothing can reassure me. He turns to my parents.
Asif, Sophia. I'll be in touch. You're in good hands with the Batavia PD.
With that, he heads out. There are no cameras, no press, nothing but policemen and an aide, I'm guessing? The aide leaves with him. I might not feel calmed by the mayor's presence, but I can tell by the way my dad's shoulders have relaxed that the mayor's promises have eased at least a little of his worry. And for now, that's enough. I know I complained to Phil that Batavia is too provincial, but I think sometimes I take the positives, the people, for granted. Violet bursts in and throws her arms around my mom. Sophia, Asif, we were so scared. Asif, does your head hurt? When they find who did this, there will be a line of people who will want to kick his ass. My father has always vaguely disapproved of Violet's casual way of calling him by his first name, not to mention her profanity, ever since we became friends. Today, it brings a gentle smile to his face.
I'm okay. Thank you, Violet. Only a cut.
Thank you for bringing Maya here. My mom finally manages. Her words are slow, deliberate. Her voice is hoarse. Dad? I ask. What exactly happened?
Your mom was in the back, and I was chatting with a couple of patients in the waiting room, and a brick came flying through the window. Glass shattered everywhere. Patients started screaming. I felt a sharp pain, then felt blood on my forehead. At first, we thought it was a bomb. I yelled at everyone to get out, and we ran out the back entrance to the parking lot. I called 911, and they told us to stay away from the building. The police came quickly with a special squad from the county in case it was an explosive. But when they went in, they saw it was a brick with a paper wrapped around it with rubber bands. Not a bomb.
What did it say? I ask. My dad hesitates. He opens and closes his mouth, but no words come out. You're dead, you fucking terrorists, my mom quotes. And it had our home address written on the bottom. Her face is grim, and her voice barely audible as she says what my dad won't. Or can't. I cover my mouth with my hand. I've never heard my mom drop the F-bomb before. My stomach churns. I taste the bile rising in my throat.
My dad gently squeezes my mom's elbow.
She looks away, not interested in reassurance or affection.
We should stay somewhere else, in a hotel, or with my sister, she says. At least until they catch whoever did this. It's too dangerous to stay at home. I shake my head instinctively. I get it. She's frightened. She's a mom worried for her kids' safety. But nowhere is safe. The logistics don't even work. But they might never catch the guy. And how am I supposed to go to school if we're at Hina's? I'm trying to keep the panic out of my voice. Maya can stay with me, Violet offers. I know my dad will be cool with it, and I drive her to school anyway. My mom shakes her head no. Violet doesn't give up. If you're worried, we can always ask the police to beef up the patrol around my house. And we have an alarm system, since my dad is totally anxious about how quiet it is here. It will be safer for everyone if Maya stays with family.
Will you please stop talking like I'm not here? I demand. I can decide for my...
No. No. My father interrupts. No one is going anywhere. We're going to stay at home and go to work, and Maya will go to school like everything is normal.
But it's not normal. Look at what happened today. After so many years in this town with no trouble. I'm taking Maya to Hina's. You can stay here if you want.
My mother mutters the last words under her breath. He takes her hand.
John, you are right. It is not normal.
It's a death threat. My mom's voice turns from fearful to frantic as she begins arguing with my dad in Urdu. I sigh. It was only a matter of time until they took to their personal language. Of course they do. It cloaks them in the feeling of home, but it leaves me on the outside looking in. Violet and I walk out, leaving my parents to their quarrel. They don't even notice I'm gone. When I turn back to look at them through the glass door, I see my mom gesticulating wildly. My dad catches my eye and then nods at my mom to stop. They walk out to join us. The chief of police approaches. He walks with purpose, wide, confident steps, eyes forward, shoulders back. I haven't done anything, but I still feel like I'm about to get busted. The fact that he carries a gun seems utterly redundant. He stretches out his hand and removes his silver-rimmed glasses with the other.
Miss Aziz, I'm Chief Wickham, Batavia PD.
He remembers to add a smile when he shakes my hand, like someone told him he's less intimidating that way. Hi, officer, chief, sir.
Officer Jameson tells me you reported trouble at school. A student named Brian Jennings harassed you?
Crap. I did not want to bring up the Brian incident. Not now. Especially not with my mom in emotional overload. I catch Violet's eye. She gives me a sympathetic grin. My parents take positions flanking me. They heard it all.
What happened at school? Did you get hurt?
My mom's distress kicks into hyperdrive.
See? I'm right. It's too dangerous here.
Mom, relax, I say, despite knowing that relaxing is not in her wheelhouse. I turn to the police chief. Name-calling, that's all. No big deal. This is another situation best handled by a little white lie about my feelings. The chief nods.
Has anything like this happened before? With Brian or anyone else?
I shake my head. There was that weird incident at the idle hour when Brian saw me with Phil,
but I don't think being a jerk qualifies as a reportable offense. The chief turns to my parents. Clearly, they've already been acquainted.
Doctor and Dr. Aziz, I'll send officers Jameson and Olson home with your family.
He gestures to the two cops standing at their squad car.
I'll put them on first watch at your place.
Can they check around our house in full, in case?
My mother raises a trembling hand to her mouth.
Of course. And when we're finished here, I will personally escort your husband home.
I can drive Maya and Sophia, and they can wait with me in the car until the officers give us the all clear, Violet offers.
Thank you, Violet,
my dad says. His voice is level. It's his response to my mom's frenzy. The more she freaks out, the calmer he sounds. My dad nods to the chief, who turns and walks with long strides to Officer Jameson's car.
Don't worry, John,
he says to my mom. She walks away from us without saying a word. She's in tears by the time she reaches Violet's car. I pause outside our front door, bracing myself. My mom has already rushed into the house. Violet hugged me extra long before driving off. I take a deep breath, then another. I look down our street. It's quiet. The late afternoon sun dances off the tops of the maple trees that are planted all along the parkway. In autumn, the street is ablaze in the reds and oranges of the leaves. When I was a kid, I would gather the brightest reds of the fallen leaves and tie them with scraps of ribbon into little bouquets for my mom. She would always feign surprise and delight and place the leaves in a vase in the middle of the table. Maybe the delight was genuine? All I know is how happy it made my 7-year-old self. I would add water to the vase to make the leaves last longer, even knowing that no matter my efforts, the leaves would eventually dry and curl in on themselves. I wave at Officer Jameson as he steps back in the car after taking a look-see around the property. He's here to protect us. I clench my jaw, realizing we might actually need the protection. The vandal has our address. He knows where we live. I don't know if my mom will ever sleep well again. I don't know if I'll ever sleep again either. I sigh. Alone in the house with my mom is the last place I want to be. I fold my hands across my body, grip my twisting stomach, and scan my memory for a moment of reprieve. My mind's eye comes to rest on Phil and us floating together in the pond under the warm sun and the delicious graze of his fingertips on my skin as he helped me relax in the water. Inside the house, my mom stands at the kitchen counter. She winces while she stirs her tea, as if holding the spoon pains her. I shrink into myself. In a single afternoon, my mom has aged. She seems grayer, her movements older and labored. She opens her mouth. It takes a few seconds for the words to come out.
It's too dangerous.
The police are outside. We're safe. She talks past me.
It's too dangerous for you to be far away. You can't go to New York. You need to stay close to us. It's decided.
She betrays no emotion as she says this. She turns her back to me and continues stirring her tea. Tears flow down my face. My mom sits down at the kitchen table and takes a sip from her cup. I'm a ghost in the room. I run up the stairs and slam my bedroom door. I don't even make it to my bed. Instead, I collapse to the floor, sobbing for Phil, for New York, for the dead,
for everything we've lost. And for what I've learned, that hope is just a million shards of broken glass. At a church a few blocks from the site of the bombing, the residents of Springfield create a makeshift memorial. Pictures of those lost, flowers, teddy bears, candles flickering in the quiet night. People stand, some huddled in small groups, others alone, softly crying. The mayor of Springfield, gray-faced and somber, speaks to the group from the church steps. Springfield, Illinois is a small city and a great one. As we mourn, America mourns with us. We will give aid and comfort to those who have been injured and to those who have lost loved ones in this tragedy. We will find our strength in our faith and in one another. We will emerge stronger. We will rebuild. We will dedicate ourselves to the unfinished work of those who have perished here. And through us, through our memories, their spirits will live. He pauses, clears his throat. God bless Springfield. God bless Illinois. God bless America. Chapter 15. I try to keep my head down at school, but the vandalism at my parents' office, combined with my friendly police escort, make me an attention magnet. And by attention, I mean open-mouthed, you're-a-freak stares, or puppy-dog eyes and shoulder pats. I want to disappear, blend into the throng of students scurrying to class. But you can't blend in when you're the only brown kid in a swell of white students. I can't remember a single thing from any class, except that Brian was absent. Suspended. Small blessings. The day ends with me at my locker, sighing heavily as I fill my backpack. When I stand, Phil is beside me. He leans forward like he wants to whisper something, but my withering glance holds him back. Apparently, I have the power to freeze-frame people mid-step. A single kind word from him, and I will fall utterly to pieces. What I want is for him to flash me a brilliant smile, to take determined strides toward me and kiss me in front of everyone. What I really want is to do that myself. I block the scene so when we kiss, faces around us blur, a filtered lens diffuses the light, and a smoke machine blows gauzy wisps of gray across the floor. And when we stop, I tell him my parents have changed their minds. I'm going to film school. I'm leaving for New York, and he's coming with me. Then he draws me close, and we kiss again, as the end flashes across the screen. In real life, he turns and walks away. Violet agrees to join me at my parents' clinic so I can document the aftermath of the crime. Filming calms me. I said before that my camera is my shield, but when I'm hiding behind it, I'm also in control. There are a couple police cars in front of the office, along with a brown van with white letters reading Glass Doctor, parked at the curb. The large plywood board that last night covered the broken window now leans against the brick wall. I hand Violet my minicam. I'm going to take my good camera. Maybe you can help me get a few establishing shots? Violet nods. I wait for her usual comment, something pithy or flirtatious. I mean, the handsome, gum-chewing Captain America-esque Officer Jameson is just feet away. But nothing. A nod is all I get. Then a slight smile that doesn't find its way to her eyes. Violet rubs my shoulder, then turns, camera in hand, to quietly honor my request. I raise my good camera to my eye.
From a distance, I film my father speaking to the window repairman. He slumps as he talks. The gray hair at his temples seems more prominent. I approach the broken window, slowly panning across the yellow crime scene tape that stretches the length of the one-story building. Through the window frame, I focus on the slivers of sparkly glass that escaped the vacuum. My father looks up, sees me with my camera, and narrows his wary eyes. Then he just nods, probably too tired to argue with me about this not being the right time or place to film. But what he doesn't get is that it is exactly the right time to film. I walk into the waiting room, camera on. I greet Rose, the receptionist, who's been with my parents' practice since the beginning. She looks up and smiles into my lens, and then pretends to engross herself in her work. But what could she possibly be doing? My parents aren't seeing patients right now. They can't. The office is still closed. Maybe it's habit. After years of watching me film, Rose is happy to play along, to star or cameo. I've promised her a shout-out if I ever win an Oscar. I'm not even exactly sure what I want to do with the film. Right now, I'll take as much raw footage as possible. There's maybe a short doc in all of this. One I could even enter in a student film festival. Something positive has to come out of this senselessness. My mom walks into the waiting room with the same drawn face she's worn since yesterday. Maya, why are you filming? We don't need memories of this. She trails off. Her voice has run out of batteries. Maybe the footage will be helpful for the insurance company? It's a feeble excuse, but she nods anyway and then heads toward the back without another word. Maybe she's right. I don't need to document the last 3 days. I need to delete them from existence. Outside, my dad, Violet, and 3 police officers surround the open window of Officer Jameson's squad car. The radio blasts. Violet gestures for me to hurry up and join them. A man's deep voice rings over the car's speakers. "It's not him. It's not him," Violet repeats as I jog up to the car. "It's not who?" "They don't think the Aziz guy is the terrorist. It's not him." I put my hand to my chest to catch my breath. I squeeze my eyes shut. My mind's camera rolls. The newscaster's words emerge from the radio in 3 dimensions, hanging in the air in block letters. Truck rental linked to suspect with possible white supremacist ties. Aziz cleared. Citizenship, his American dream. Police execute search warrants. My mouth hangs open. I should be more relieved that a Muslim isn't responsible, but all I can think of is the carnage. Over 100 people are dead, and there have been dozens of attacks on Muslims in retaliation for a crime no Muslim committed. My father and the police stand at grim-faced attention until the station breaks for commercial. Officer Jameson turns down the dial.
"Let's hope this curbs the threats from our neighborhood vandal. I'm going to check with the chief. I'm sure he'll want a police detail to stick with your family at least another day."
My dad nods, his mind clearly elsewhere.
"Thank you. If you'll excuse me, I need to tell my wife the news."
He doesn't say a word to me. He hurries toward his office without glancing back. Violet takes me home.
We raid the fridge.
She grabs a couple leftover samosas and tosses them into the microwave. I pour us glasses of chilled mango juice.
"I wish I had vodka to spike those," Violet says. I have to laugh.
It feels good. Yeah, that would go over big with the parentals. I'm trying to help you relax. You should be psyched it's not the Muslim guy. It's some asshole white supremacist dude. This will all blow over, and your parents will let you go to New York. We should be celebrating. I shake my head. That's not how it's going to work. Violet's impish smile fades. Why not? Are you kidding? All this stuff happened when they only suspected it was a Muslim. Imagine if the next time it actually is a Muslim. Like that guy, someone who just happens to have my last name, which is actually sort of common. My parents told me all these stories about things that happened after 9/11. People getting beat up or harassed because they were brown. Some of them weren't even Muslims. This brick through the window? The Brian bullshit at school? I don't see how my mom is going to recover. Or my dad, by the looks of it. As I'm saying these words to Violet, I suddenly fear that my parents could take a lot more away from me than just NYU. They could take away Batavia. They could insist we move somewhere else and start over. Maybe your aunts can talk to your mom? Violet says softly. My mom is still pissed at her for aiding and abetting on the whole applying to NYU thing. I slump back in my chair. I can't ask Hina for anything else. Besides, she has her own life. Violet takes a bite out of the samosa in front of her and gulps down her juice. I know it's bleak, but don't give up. We'll find a way. I'm silent. I give my head a little shake. What's stopping you? She demands. It's a simple question, but there is no simple answer. That infuriates me. I can't do whatever I want. I can't be whatever I want. No matter what, someone I love will get hurt.
WGN-TV, Chicago Local News. As cleanup crews continue the arduous process of sorting through the wreckage of the federal building here in downtown Springfield, this surprise from the FBI. Kamal Aziz, initial suspect in the terrorist attack, appears to be a victim himself. Initial reports tied Mr. Aziz to a terrorist splinter group, but the FBI is now calling it a simple case of mistaken identity. In fact, Mr. Aziz was in the federal building that day to take part in a citizenship ceremony. He and 50 others were to take an oath to swear allegiance to the United States, to become our nation's newest citizens, when a suicide bomber cut that dream short. Mr. Aziz was a resident at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. His parents, local store owners in Dearborn, Michigan, mourn him now as the 125th victim of the suicide attack.
Chapter 16. Life at home is hushed. My parents and I shuffle around like cordial strangers. Sometimes I can barely even muster cordial. Every time I look at them, all I see in their eyes is fear and worry about the state of their practice and the state of our lives. And they might not acknowledge it, but they must sense the resentment that comes off me in waves. It's like we're all unavoidable reminders to one another of what we've lost. So I now have one mission in life. Avoid my parents. That, and to not think of Phil. Or New York. Or all the opportunities I'm missing. My brain hurts from thinking about all the stuff I swear not to think about. It's Saturday night. I'm not on the work schedule at the bookstore. Violet is going to a party at our friend Monica's house and wants me to come. She's texted me 3 times in the last hour.
Just what I need. To go to some party and walk in on Phil and Lisa making out. Not that I even know Phil is even going to be there, but still can't risk it. I can't keep ignoring her, so I text, "Too tired," and turn off my phone. With nothing to do and nowhere to go, I drive. I drive through town and the houses that sprouted up overnight where once there were only cornfields. I drive down the dark, empty road behind the grocery store to where Batavia's mythic Lincoln tree once stood. They chopped it down 2 decades ago when the tree got sick, but according to old Batavia lore, when the leaves were green and full, the elm looked exactly like Abraham Lincoln's profile. It faced in the direction of Bellevue, the sanitarium where Mary Todd Lincoln was forced to stay for a while in the 1870s. They say that when the summer breeze was just so, the branches of the elm would dip down and give the face the appearance of weeping. I drive on, unable to weep anymore. When I find myself at the Fabian Forest Preserve, it feels almost like an accident. Almost. I kill the headlights and drive along the road that parallels the river. The car creeps along a half mile of crunchy gravel. The pond is the best place to wallow in my wretched state. Why not go to the place that will hurt the most to see how much I can stand? It's why I watch the Sullivan Ballou letter to his wife scene in the Ken Burns doc, The Civil War, over and over. Because I'm challenging my own heart to burst. He was a Union officer, and probably the most romantic guy ever. That letter is so full of longing and gratitude for his wife being in his life. "My love for you is deathless," he wrote. He died a week after writing it. She never received the letter. Their tragedy kills me every single time. Sometimes I think that letter is why documentaries need to exist, to show us the almost unbearable truth about ourselves. As I drive up to the entrance of the Japanese garden, I see Phil's car parked in front of the no trespassing sign. Damn it! My chest tightens. I clasp the steering wheel, afraid it will take flight, but I barely have time to panic. I do a quick U-turn and skid away. Gravel shoots up behind the car. He's seen me, I'm sure of it. Or heard me, at least. And no one else comes to this place. The space in the car shrinks, closing in on me. Was Phil there with Lisa? No, 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 crap! I don't even try to stop myself from crying. I pound the side of my right fist into my thigh when I stop at the first light. I've run out of road, so I drive home. The dark house is a relief. A note on the foyer table in my mom's handwriting reads, "At the mosque, then going to the cons." Since the bombing last week, my parents have gone to prayers every day. I can understand. It gives them a sense of peace and purpose, a place to belong when no other place feels welcoming. But nothing at home has changed. We communicate mostly by notes now. I know they're scared. I'm scared too. A part of my heart aches for them. But another part of my heart can't forgive them for reneging on their promise. I walk into the kitchen and open the fridge. I linger long enough to hear my mother's voice in my head. "Shut the door, Maya. You are defrosting everything." She made parathas while I was at work. I slather butter on a paratha and throw it into the microwave for 30 seconds. Since I'm eating my feelings, though, buttery flatbread is not enough. I open the freezer and grab a pint of mint chip ice cream, find a spoon, and head to my room. In low light, I kick off my shoes and sit cross-legged in the middle of my bed. Giant spoonfuls of ice cream aren't enough either. I need a friendly voice, a person who understands without me having to explain. I need Kareem. We haven't talked since the bombing. We've texted. I'm not sure if I should call, but my entire body pulls me to the phone. He always says I can call him whenever. Hope he means it. I hold the phone to my ear while I put down my food and settle into my bed. I count the rings. Of course he's out. It's Saturday night. I should hang up, but caller ID. I ready myself to leave a breezy message, but a breathless female voice answers in the middle of the fifth ring. Hello? I think... Sorry, I must have the wrong number. Who are you looking for? Kareem? He stepped out for a second. He'll be right back. Oh, okay. Thanks, I say, trying to hide my embarrassment. I'll yell down the hall for him. Can I tell him who's calling? Maya. The documentarian? I guess that's me. Hang on. The woman pulls the phone away from her mouth, but I can still hear her yelling for Kareem. Babe? Phone! It's Maya! There's scuffling, and then Kareem's muffled voice says,
Give me 5 minutes. I'll be right behind you.
And then I hear something like a kiss. Definitely a kiss.
Maya? What's up?
He sounds worried. Hey, thought I'd give you a ring, but I guess I caught you at a bad time. I bite my bottom lip. I want desperately to sound coolly detached, but not like I'm trying too hard to sound coolly detached. Basically, Lauren Bacall in To Have and Have Not, but less insolent and more Indian. Another movie Hina made me watch.
No worries, he says. Everything good with you?
Yeah, sure. But I don't want to keep you from... I'm fishing for the woman's name, obviously.
Soraya.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Chill. It's fine. I've been meaning to call you, to see how things have been since the vandalism at your parents' clinic. How have they been holding up?
You should go. You don't want to keep Soraya waiting. A whirling fireball grows in my chest. I have no right to feel this way, but I do.
Maya, you sound kind of...
I'm surprised, that's all. I didn't expect someone else to answer your phone.
Soraya and I got back together last week.
Back together? I gulp.
Remember in your backyard my broken-hearted sob story? Soraya was the breaker.
And now you're back with her? I try and sound upbeat and friendly instead of simply confused. I'm fairly certain I'm completely failing.
Funny how life works, right? The timing wasn't right then. We both had growing up to do. Anyway, we had dinner a couple weeks ago, and the whole meal, neither of us could stop smiling. We decided to give it... us another try.
Kareem's happiness sings in my ear. I can't begrudge him. After all, I'm the one who threw us away. I knew then, as I do now, that we weren't meant to be together. So it makes no sense that I'm hurting the way I am.
It may seem weird, but Soraya and I... she gets me, you know? We can be together, and it's easy. I don't have to pretend to be something I'm not.
He pauses.
You know how when life gets too complicated, it's easy to overthink everything? Intellectualize too much?
Please, I'm the president of Overthinkers Anonymous. I'm their patron saint. Kareem laughs.
Sometimes you've got to be less cerebral and more intuitive. So I figured I'd take a chance, trust my heart, and be less concerned about all the made-up things that are supposedly getting in our way. Cue segue. So, how are things with Phil?
Don't ask. I think he's back together with Lisa.
You think?
Maybe? I'm not sure. Things have been so confusing and messed up the last couple weeks.
Well, the bright lights of New York City are right around the corner. Plenty of new adventures to be had.
New York's not meant to be either. My throat tightens. I can no longer even feign being cool and detached. I am the total opposite.
Why? What happened?
My mom totally freaked, and now my parents refuse to let me go to NYU. I'm going to live with my aunt and go to school in Chicago. I can't even live on campus. It's that or community college and live at home.
He takes a breath. Holy shit. That sucks. I'm so sorry, Maya. They're still being that way, even though they discovered the bomber wasn't a Muslim?
Believe it or not, my mom actually argued that the fact that the terrorist wasn't Muslim added to her point. It's too dangerous, even when the guy isn't Muslim, so imagine if the next terrorist is.
And your dad's going along with it? It makes no sense.
I know. He's totally on her side. No matter how irrational she acts. Obviously, he agrees with her, but he won't say it out loud, just defers to her instead. And without them paying for it, there's no way I can afford NYU.
Has your aunt tried talking to them?
Hina is the one who came up with the idea of me living with her, so I can have a semblance of freedom and not have to live with my parents.
Maya, listen.
His voice grows urgent.
Whatever happens, you can't stop making your movies. Promise you won't give up. You've got to fight for what you want.
My eyes begin to sting. But I'm tired of fighting. I tried to step out of the stereotypical good Indian girl mold with Phil, my movies, New York. And now my whole life is a dumpster fire. So what's the point? I hear Saraya call Kareem.
Sorry,
he mutters.
I gotta run. Listen, if you give up now, you'll regret it later. That I know.
I'll take it under advisement.
It'll work out. I know it. I'm here if you need me. Listen to your gut, okay?
Got it. See ya. If I listened to my gut, I'd be throwing up right now.
Good Morning Springfield, TV 7. The authorities have traced the partial license plate and VIN from the vehicle that exploded to a rental agency on the Illinois-Indiana border. The truck was rented to an Ethan Branson, a 19-year-old Indiana resident with apparent ties to white supremacist organizations. Mr. Branson frequently commented on right-wing extremist websites with strong anti-government rhetoric and attended meetings of the Midwestern Knights of Brotherhood in Indiana. Materials found in his motel room here in Springfield indicate he acted alone.
Chapter 17.
Every spring, a few weeks before graduation, the senior class heads to the American Adventure Amusement Park. I'm not exactly a fan of vertigo-inducing roller coasters, but at least it's a break from the stone-cold silent tomb of my house. Not to mention a distraction from the incessant prom talk, the bitter icing on the rotten cake of senior year. It's also the perfect day to film. I'm making Violet a movie of senior year as a grad gift, so documenting our last senior outing together is absolutely necessary. I take my camera in hand, roll sound, roll camera, and action.
Technically, I have no assistant director and no boom operator, and in fact, no boom. But in my head, I like to sound authentic.